Brian McCreath, and this is the answered question from WCRB in Boston for October 6th, 2017. This is Gil Shaham's recording of the Violin Concerto by Tchaikovsky with the Singapore Symphony and conductor Lan Shui. And it's the piece Shaham is playing this week with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Andres Nelsons leads the BSO in a program that also includes Arlene Sierra's Moller and Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, and WCRB will have the concert for you live on Saturday night at 8 p.m. And Gil Shaham is one of the guests on this podcast. Also on the podcast is pianist Garrick Olson in a conversation recorded at Tanglewood a couple of months ago. Olson's Tanglewood performances of the two piano concertos by Chopin are available to hear on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. The last time Gil Shaham played with the BSO at Symphony Hall, he was the soloist in the Violin Concerto by John Williams. And he described talking through the piece with John Williams and how fun it was to work with him that way. So when I met Gil after a rehearsal earlier this week, I asked him, if he had the chance, what he would ask Tchaikovsky about his violin concerto.
Oh, wow. Wouldn't that be amazing? This concerto to me is such a miracle, and it's something so inspired. From the little that I know about Tchaikovsky, my understanding is that he lived a lot of his life quite tormented and depressed, but this concerto seemed to have come at a very short period of several months when he was very happy, and he wrote it very quickly, and it's this perfect flash of inspiration. And I think violin writing changed forever after that. Even some of the compositions that now you mentioned that I think about with John Williams, I think we're all inspired by the way he wrote for the violin here.
And at first it was the first guy he wrote it for thought it couldn't even be played. It was unplayable. So he must have changed something about how violin writing happens, because this guy felt like he couldn't even do it. Leopold Auer thought it couldn't be played.
Apparently he was a close friend of Tchaikovsky's, and Tchaikovsky was a great admirer. I find it difficult. I mean, at my age, I find, a lot of things difficult. But, I guess one of my thoughts about this piece always was that there are passages that remind me of... He knew the Beethoven violin concerto thoroughly, and the Mozart violin concertos as well. There are some passages to my ear remind me of Wieniawski's Second Concerto. And I guess... when you ask me what I would ask him, I would talk to him, was that a piece that he was interested in? It was a very successful piece at the time, and one of Wieniawski's greatest hits. And Wieniawski was a Polish violinist that then became the head of the Moscow Conservatory. And so I wonder, what the inspiration was for this piece.
So your entry point to it, when you first began playing it, was it through a teacher? Did someone guide you through it? Or were you kind of inspired by a particular performance or recording that you heard of the piece when you really first began to take it seriously as a violinist?
Just now when you asked the question, I was remembering being maybe 9 years old, and I heard a young violinist, Erez Ofer, who is now living in Berlin, and wonderful violinist. He was a few years older than me, and I remember him playing this with a pianist, and just thinking, this is the most beautiful music I ever heard. one day, I want to learn to play this. And then I remember distinctly a few years later listening to Isaac Stern's recording with Eugene Stoneman and the Philadelphia Orchestra. And I remember listening to that over and over and over again. But in particular, when after the first 5 or 6 minutes, the first chapter that the violin introduces, the orchestra finally comes in with the tune, and in an A major that you've been expecting. You've been trying to cadence in A major for the last 5 minutes, and they finally cadence, and the tune comes in, and it's the most incredibly satisfying feeling. And I used to just wait for that part, and then once it would get there, I'd be like, this is unbelievable, and go back. Listen to the whole thing again until we got to that spot. This because I spoke to a young lady a short while ago, and she told me that's what she does, and she's an 11-year-old now, and she says, I love the Tchaikovsky. I love that part where the orchestra comes in with the tune. And yes, you're right. I feel the same. And my last story about this, I have a good friend actually at the school where my kids are. They're fellow parents who are musicians. He's you know, part musician, part lawyer. But he said when he was a teenager, he heard the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto and it changed his life. And that is the reason he decided to become a musician. It was because he heard the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, and the way he says it, he said, I never heard anything like that before.
It first was almost not played at all, and now it's indispensable. Everybody has to have it somewhere in their lives. Do you feel like as you've since those early days when you were 9 years old, and as a teenager when you learned it, I mean, do you feel like it is? Does it feel different now for you at this age?
You know, I play it very differently.
Oh yeah.
Today, I feel like I have more perspective, maybe, with age and with having listened to more music and played more music. But I have enough experience to know that I'm probably deluding myself, and I may be wrong. But these days, I find that I enjoy it even more. I find that I enjoy it even more. And in a way, I think the perfection of it is very classical, and I see it as more of a classical work, but on the other side, I feel like the expression of it is so intense and so different from any violin concerto written before that I consider it to be a much more romantic work than I used to at the same time. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but yeah.
Absolutely. No, it does. It does. I mean, that's that our familiarity with a particular piece of art sort of is always in relation to what is around us at the moment, and seeing that more classical structure, maybe that makes sense at this time of life, I guess, you know.
You know, I remember a quote of Tchaikovsky's something about, and I don't remember the exact words, but he talks about building beautiful pedestals so that after you finish building the pedestal, you know, he's speaking about music, you are able to put the beautiful statue on top of it. And I think a moment like that, where that beautiful melody, which is, you know, it's interestingly, it's the same rhythm as many of the Mozart violin concertos. But once that melody comes on that pedestal, it is like a beautiful statue. And you see how the pedestal is built. Suddenly, the last 3 minutes that you heard make sense as the pedestal that presents that beautiful statue.
Nice. Yeah. I like that. I always have to ask you every time I see you about the 1930s Violin Concerto Project, because I love it so much. The last time we talked, you mentioned the Roger Sessions Concerto as a possibility as part of that series. I don't know. Is there any update that you have on that series of recordings?
Well, I don't remember if we spoke before I played it or after. It was only a few years.
You were on your way to Aspen to do it a few months later.
That's exactly right. So I did play it and I loved it. And I'm hoping to have a chance to record it and add it to our 1930s collection. This incredible time when, you know, for violinists, one iconic masterwork of a concerto was written after the other. I think we're hoping to do the Korngold Violin Concerto soon, which is an interesting piece. It was actually published in 1945, but Korngold's philosophy sort of stopped him from publishing music during the Second World War. And if I remember correctly, he said that as long as the Reich is in power, he will not write concert music. And he kept writing film scores to support his family. And the material for the violin concerto was written in the 1930s. And as soon as the war was over in 1945, he went out and published the violin concerto. So it's a little bit, you know, the publishing date was 1945, but we're going to include it in the 1930s because the material came from then.
That's a lot. And I'll look forward to it. That's great. I love that idea. Gil Shaham, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Gil Shaham is the soloist with the Boston Symphony Orchestra this week in the Violin Concerto by Tchaikovsky. And he'll be playing the piece with the BSO during the orchestra's upcoming tour to Japan in November. As for that series of 1930s violin concerto recordings, it really is a tremendous project with two volumes out already. And I was thrilled to hear that it will eventually include Eric Wolfgang Korngold's concerto, which is just a gorgeous piece. And speaking of Korngold, you can hear his music on Sunday night this weekend on WCRB in concert with the Boston Chamber Music Society. Alan McClellan brings you that program, which includes the A Major Piano Quartet by Brahms, the very rarely heard piano quartet by Mahler, and a string sextet by Korngold. It all starts at 7 p.m. on Sunday. Last summer at Tanglewood, I had a really nice conversation with pianist Garrick Olson. He was the Kuzovitsky artist for the summer, which is quite a bit more than an honorary title. You'll hear more about that in this interview, which took place at the Shed while the BSO was rehearsing Mendelssohn's Midsummer Night's Dream, something that will be very evident as you listen. Olson played the two Chopin piano concertos on consecutive nights with the BSO at Tanglewood, which was appropriate because his own career was launched when he won the 1970 Chopin competition in Poland. So I asked him just how different his life became after that competition victory.
It was extremely different because the competition brought me what I had dreamed about and what young pianists thought such a competition could do, which in those days happens more than now. There are many more piano competitions, the world is more crowded, and when you win the Chopin, it doesn't put you on the front page of the New York Times and the Boston Globe and the London Times and the, you know, Tokyo, whatever, which it did then. I just knew that if you won one of the three most important competitions in the world, and this is one, for a pianist, your name would be on the front page of every major paper. Not above the fold, it wasn't headline news, but, you know, there's, you know, American pianist wins Chopin Prize in Warsaw, continued on page 48, you know. And now, in 2015, when Sung Jin Cho won the Chopin competition, I waited 3 weeks to read about it in the New York Times, and I was actually not happy about that. So, anyway, to answer your question more directly, it changed my life immensely, and the great impresario Saul Urok, whose management I was actually with for about a year after that, liked to quote me because I said before the night before I won the Chopin Prize, I was a young aspiring American pianist who had two or three dates the next season. The night or perhaps the week afterwards, I had 100 concerts worldwide. So that's what competitions can actually do for you. So I became a full-time professional traveling pianist at that point.
And when it comes to the music itself, though, you've continued to be someone who has Chopin around all the time. You do tons of other things. I mean, I'm not sure I know a pianist with a wider range of repertoire than you, but Chopin continues to be there for you. And was Chopin a really important composer to you before the competition?
Oh, indeed, indeed. Well, I would say that for anybody who's a serious pianist, he is one of the Rosetta Stones. I mean, he teaches you how to play the piano. He's one of the most important. He is the piano composer of all time. I mean, he developed the sound of the instrument and the technical possibilities on it more than anybody at that time. And, I mean, what the 20th century added to piano technique is about 8% of the total. I mean, if you've got Chopin, you've got almost all of it, if you can play it well. I always loved his music. Of course, I love lots of music, but I was one of the reasons I entered the Chopin competition was I wanted to deepen my knowledge and understanding of Chopin, because I knew that even if I didn't win the competition, and you cannot, nobody, I hope young pianists are listening, nobody can plan to win a competition like that. Too many things happen. Even if you happen to be the best, whatever that means, you know, you can have the flu and that can just torpedo it, or something awful can happen. So I really loved Chopin and wanted to develop him. And once I won the prize, you know, Chopin is not only Poland's greatest and favorite composer and one of the world's favorites, but he's kind of a secular saint and almost a cult there. And as it should be, as Mozart is in Austria and others. I just felt I knew him better and loved him more. And, of course, I had the emotional association of winning the competition, which gave him my career. Also, I had the emotional association of this incredible public, which knows Chopin so much better than any public in America or most of Europe even knows music. He's theirs. So I wanted to just know further, and this public which lived in an age of, you know, it was an occupied country, there was repression, there was economic poverty, lack of TV stations, lack of all the things we took for granted. So music becomes even more important in those circumstances. So, and it's a public that, well, for example, when I gave my victory recital in Warsaw after the competition, I got to the 13th encore, I didn't know anything else. Now, let me tell you, when you're 22 and that happens to you, you feel like you're Arthur Rubinstein or something, because it's like, oh my God, you know. they take me and this subject very seriously. So that game was a great blessing. So I had all kinds of motivations. And I just, the reason I recorded all of Chopin and played cycles of his solo works was several fold. As you may have surmised, I like to do many things at once, achieve several goals at once. So I, with the Chopin cycles and recordings, I was at the middle of my career. And even though careers that are successful look inevitable, they never are. They're always built. And you actually have to deal with the business of art as well as the art. And here is where the coincidence of the two was very happy, because when you're a young pianist and you've made a splash, it's one thing. When you're in the middle of your career and you're well known, how can you get legitimate attention for yourself, artistically or personally or whatever? I mean, you could write a cookbook too, but that's, you know, lots of people can do that who can't play Chopin or Beethoven. And so I wanted to do something that was artistically meaningful and deepening for me, and but it fulfilled the task of, you know, getting a lot of legit, what I would call legitimate attention for me. And also, we have a taste in our time, and this still goes on, we like complete. Record companies will tell you if you put complete on something, it will sell better. I don't know what, I guess maybe it's the human acquisition, you know, like, oh, I've got the complete works of Tolstoy there on the shelf. You want to have a look. Something is pride in ownership, or pride in knowledge, actually. I mean, I remember a number of years ago I went to Fine Arts, and there was a Picasso exhibition with timed tickets, of course, of Picasso between 1900 and 1920. It wasn't go to Fine Arts and look at all the wonderful paintings, or it wasn't look at all of Picasso. It was Picasso. I mean, it was so concentrated, and people were there by the thousands. So I think that it's a wonderful thing that people want to have a somewhat deeper experience, not just, oh, I went to a museum and I saw some nice stuff, but it's like, let's really get into what this creator is doing. So anyway, it's a nice thing.
And that's, in a way, what you chose to do here with the BSO this summer as the Kuzovitsky artist. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so for two appearances with the BSO, the complete concertos by Chopin, the two.
All two.
All two of them. And I guess what I wonder is, those were written so close to each other, and Chopin was still a young guy. What distinguishes one from the other for someone who's just kind of coming upon them?
Well, not actually an enormous amount. They're completely different, just like any two siblings are, but they definitely have a family resemblance. Number one, Chopin wrote them when he was 19 and 20. So that puts him, I guess, about fourth in the musical maturity sweepstakes for young geniuses. I think, you'll be surprised when I tell you who's number one is Scriabin. He wrote his first masterpiece, which is a piece all pianists play, the Etude in C-sharp minor, opus 2, number 1, when he was 15.
Wow.
Which is really, I mean, to write a perfect, completely inspired, completely well-made piece that just captures people's hearts and minds, that's pretty good for 15. It took Mendelssohn until he was 16.
I was just going to say, so we're on a tangent here. Yeah. So you're saying
Mozart was a slowpoke. He was 18 right. Before he got there. Mozart wrote a lot of marvelous music before he was 18.
Yeah. But
when he was 18, there was a decisive turning point. And so Chopin is a Johnny come lately at 19.
So you would go Scriabin, Mendelssohn, Mozart, Chopin.
I know not everybody will agree with me,
but it's okay.
And so with the Chopin concertos, number one, he wrote them as calling cards for himself to conquer Europe, which he did. He would visit the great capital cities and get himself known. So you had to have piano and orchestra music. He was completely uninterested in the orchestra. And once these are his last pieces with orchestra, and he wrote a few small concert pieces too, but they're all about the piano. The better the orchestra and the conductor do, the less they'll be noticed. They play an opening tutti with all the melodies, and then they basically disappear for the rest, while the piano has a soliloquy. Very much in this, both pieces in Chopin's Italian opera style, he was kind of a snob. He only really loved Bach and Mozart, and he loved Italian opera. The rest he was not so crazy about. Beethoven for him was a powerful and important figure, but no influence at all. Whereas the rest of the 19th century, you know, either had to go towards Beethoven or go away from him. And for Chopin, Beethoven was just not a problem. He was just a different guy. He admired Beethoven, but, you know, he wasn't worried about the great influence. So there's a lot of beautiful, beautiful melody that sounds like singing, although Chopin's melodies cannot be sung. If you try, you'll notice they don't fit in anybody's voice, but they evoke singing. And then there's a lot of brilliant virtuosity, mostly of the delicate kind for the solo piano, and a lot of brilliance. There's, in the case of the F minor, written when he was 19, his first greatest masterpiece is the slow movement. That is a piece you can put up with the greatest music by anybody, anywhere, as all-time genius. And a lot of his music later was, too. But this is incredible for a 19-year-old, such depth and such beauty and such magic and proportion and inspiration. The finales of both are Polish folk dance derived. First is related to mazurkas. The second is related to a dance called Krakowiak from Krakow. And the first movements are a little bit more serious, but the F minor is much more volatile emotionally. It stops and starts, it turns on a dime. The E minor is a bit grander and a more public sort of piece. But they're both really beautiful. My only regret is that Chopin's greatest music comes in the solo works and often in forms like in the ballades, scherzos, nocturnes, and so on. So whenever I play a Chopin encore for an orchestra, a great orchestra like the Boston Symphony, which I do sometimes, some of the players just really only know these concertos and say, I had no idea Chopin was so deep or so great or so incredible. But because they're not pianists themselves. I mean, everybody knows some Chopin, but so.
Yeah. Well, it kind of makes you wonder. I mean, I guess he was just so sure of who he was, he had no need to write another orchestral piece.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's always interesting historically and socially. Chopin grew up in Warsaw, which, while not a European capital like Paris, London, or Vienna, was not a backwater either. I mean, it was somewhere between a provincial city and a major capital. A lot was happening there, and musical culture was developing pretty fast. But there had not been yet a composer who was not from one of the, well, I'll call them the big four. Italy, France, England, Germany, the big four countries. That's where most of our well-known music before that comes from, the music that has lasted. He was the first who came from outside the center. He was the first ethnic. He was the first exotic. And he was, at the time, very exotic. We no longer see him as exotic. But he brought a perfume and a flavor to his music that was completely new in Central Europe. But nevertheless, there was enough of a musical structure in Warsaw that they realized that their country, which had suffered for hundreds of years and didn't even exist on the map, and was ruled by the, you know, by a Russian king, they felt that here we'll show the world that we also can produce a genius to put besides Michelangelo and Mozart and so on. And they, his teachers and everybody said, you must write masses and symphonies and concertos and operas and show the world who you are and what we can do here. And Chopin just basically did know himself awfully well. And he just paid no attention to that. And he even said in one of his letters or comments, he said, my kingdom is not very large, but within it I am genuinely king.
And I don't like that. That's good.
He knew. And he just wasn't either interested or maybe knew that he couldn't. You know, even great geniuses have limitations in their talents, you know, and nobody else could do what Chopin did either. So there, you know, he set musical Europe on its ear because he actually set the stage for harmonic development for the next 100 years. I mean, he was one of the greatest influences. And I mean, even Liszt, who was his friend, introduced a lot of his music to Wagner, who didn't know it. And Wagner was just blindsided by it. And in Wagner, you know, the net result is Tristan, basically, of sliding chromatic harmony, which Chopin did not invent, but he developed to a degree that nobody else had. And Tristan sets the stage for the destruction of European tonality, basically. I mean, if you just follow me in all these leaps of logic,
right?
So anyway, basically Chopin set the stage for harmonic development in European music until World War I, which is pretty incredible influence for a little pianist from Warsaw.
I should say so. Just one more question, and I mean, I could talk to you about Chopin all day, but when you were approached about being the 2017 Koussevitzky artist here at Tanglewood. It's a fairly new thing, but it's not just a title. It's not just sort of like, we like you, here's a title. It's right. A chance to do something, And I come to Tanglewood and I see what you do every summer. It already seems like so much, which is great. But when this opened up, what was your thought about, you know, how did you approach the idea that you could do more here?
Oh, well, I was completely delighted. And of course I worked with Tony Fogg on, you know, what's the word people use? Curating, what I'd be doing. And it's turned out to be kind of a grab bag of the wide range of stuff that I have done here and other places and that I do. Chamber music with a Takacs with an odd piece. I mean, that happened, you know. I mean, we could have played the Brahms Quintet, which is what everybody wants to buy tickets for, but it was nice to play. In an environment that would like to hear the Elgar, it was lovely to do that. The Copland is a relatively unusual piece, which I've played a fair amount, and that was a perfect Tanglewood on Parade piece. The Chopins, I have only ever played with a boss. We took a survey last year. I think I may be the person who's played more piano repertoire with this orchestra than anybody in history, except for Jesús San Román in much earlier times, who apparently had some sort of long-term association, which no longer exists. And he played all sorts of stuff. But in any case, if I live long enough, I'll probably outdo his record. I played more different works for piano and orchestra and all kinds of music associated with Tanglewood. I mean, all the Beethoven sonatas, for example, and so on. So, but it was clear that only once at Tanglewood, almost 20 years ago, I had played a Chopin concerto at all, which is odd given how much Chopin I've played in the world. So it would be a good calling card to sort of, you know, Chopin's associated with me, not only with me, lots of great pianists are associated with Chopin. But we thought that would be a really wonderful thing. And of course, then my recital has no Chopin on it. But I have played, let's see, in 2010, I did two whole Chopin recitals for the Chopin 200th birthday. So, yeah.
Well, and your recital is framed by Schubert, but largely Scriabin in the middle, right?
Well, it's mostly Schubert, but with a very big... The meat in the sandwich is Scriabin, and there's one piece of all of them that's really famous, but the rest are not so famous and shockingly great.
Well, it's such a great roundup of, as you say, things that you may have done elsewhere, but it's so great that it's all happening right here.
It also means, I mean, you know, when you become the Koussevitzky artist, that not only do you get your title, but you have to work pretty hard when you're here. And also I've done a number of classes for the TMC, and that's also always a joy. But I have been to say that I've been busy while I'm here is an understatement.
Well, as I said, that's kind of my impression of you every year here, that you tend to take on a lot, but this year maybe some more. And so once again, congratulations for the title. And it's so good to be able to talk with you a little bit today about everything.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Yeah, the Koussevitzky Award, well, that is one of those things that just falls out of the heavens on you. You can't apply for it or earn it. It's a lovely thing, and I'm pleased to be in the third year of its existence.
Thanks again.
Thanks.
You can hear Garrick Olson's Tanglewood performances of the two Chopin piano concertos on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. And by the way, you heard Garrick talk about everything he did as the Koussevitzky artist over the summer. Well, to fill in the blanks a bit, here are the details. He played the Elgar Piano Quintet with the Takács Quartet, the Copland Piano Concerto with the BSO during Tanglewood on Parade, the two Chopin piano concertos, and a recital that began and ended with Schubert sonatas and with a lot of shorter pieces by Scriabin in the middle. And all of that was in the space of less than 2 weeks. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. And TAQ is also on SoundCloud and at that website, classicalwcrb.org. Thank you to Gil Shaham and to Garrick Olson, as well as the staff of the BSO. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.